Asheville. The voices of Asheville. Listen live anywhere at WPVM.org.
This is Wild Heart at WPVM 103.7 FM, where we gather for conversation with passionate voices from our Asheville community, sharing dreams, stories, and ways of life to inspire the freedom of heart, exploring what it means to live with a wild heart. Hello and welcome to Wild Heart. I'm Laura Elliott, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. As the sponsor of today's show, I invite you to visit my website at lauraelliott.com, and that's Laura Elliott with two T's on Elliott. And please take a special note of the fundraiser I'm involved in for Creative Peacemakers, an incredible after-school program here in Asheville for children at risk, and all purchases of my prints, my art prints, until the end of February, a portion of those purchases goes towards their efforts to do their good works in the community. And you can check out their website at creativepeacemakers.com. And so, Wild Heart with me today are three wild-hearted women from Asheville who traveled to Washington, D.C. For the Women's March a few weeks ago. And so with me is Kendall Hale and Angela Stone and Amanda Krauss. And they all vary in length of time of their roots here in Asheville that I've just discovered. And one very recently moved here, and Amanda and Kale, 20-some years, and found out just now that Angela has 250 years of heritage here. To whatever. Yeah. It's quite a record. Yeah. So, these efforts go well beyond Asheville. And there's so much in need right now, as we're all aware, with our collective new beginning in this country within the political arena. And, I know the march gathered, thousands and was quite an awesome experience. And so we're here to hear some stories as well as the individual passions of these three women and their journeys of social activism. So welcome, Kendall, Angela.
Thank you.
Amanda.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're going to go around and just help listeners connect with you a little bit, and if you want to just give us a few words of your background, your in social activism, what have your key interests been, and what you may be currently working on. I know we're all involved in ratifying the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, in that movement. So do you want to start, Amanda?
Yeah. Gladly.
Yeah.
Most recently, I helped plan the events and coordinate the events for a march from New York City to Washington, D.C. for the Equal Rights Amendment. It was called Natalie White for Equal Rights. It was led by an artist named Natalie White, and she is from West Virginia, but she lives in New York City, and she had a platform based in art and intertwining the feminine and the feminine body and the Sisters of Liberty. She spun off the Sons of Liberty and did this the Don't Tread on Me symbol over the American flag and had it as a Sisters of Liberty. And so I coordinated the events and booked all the acts for all of the events for our march. And it was over 250 miles over 16 days in July. And that was my most recent thing that I did in terms of organizing for the awareness of the Equal Rights Amendment, but actually going to DC was so amazing. And so that was really amazing to be able to do that with Natalie and Camila Lopez, who is the woman who made the documentary film called Equal Means Equal. Mm-hmm. And I know we'll be talking about that later. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I worked on DC statehood, and that all came to be because we legalized cannabis in D.C., and I was part of a big movement with a group called DC MJ, And so I was a volunteer coordinator for that. And it was amazing because we actually got all of the people in DC to sign ballot initiative. And it took over 50,000 signatures. And it was amazing that we were able to get that on the ballot and that the people were able to actually pass something on their own. And that's what we need to turn North Carolina into, is a legislative state so that we can get things done like that here. Mm. And that's going to be something I'm really excited to work on now that I live here.
Mm. Wonderful involvements. And you know, it is pretty incredible, isn't it, once you get involved in that. And that was quite an effort, organizing that march from New York to D.C. I mean, all the people you meet, the expansion of your network, and just all the avenues that are created from stepping into one direction.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was able to connect with organizers from New Jersey now, Pennsylvania now, Delaware now, and women from the Equal Rights Amendment Coalition. It was beautiful to be in the audience of such powerful people who have such outreach, and that was awesome. So I'm really grateful for that experience. But at the same time, it was amazing to see that when I got to meet them and see that they're such powerful people, they empowered me. And then I realized, well, I'm just a regular, average, everyday American citizen with, like, I have an associate's degree, you know, anybody can go out there and stand up and be a citizen who is actually active. And that was what was most exciting, was that I was able to hear their stories and hear that they're just regular people. And the power of regular people is that when we link arms, we have such a strong voice. And that was what was so amazing about doing that march and actually, like, meeting homeless women who have their kids in Baltimore and they're, like, trying to make it to a shelter or listen to us talk about what we want to do for them. And that was really powerful, to meet people from all walks of life just walking and physically being out in public and even going through dangerous areas where the kids are asking you, why are you there? And they're 14 years old and it's almost dusk. And then the police drive up and they say, we actually would like to escort you to the next jurisdiction because this is a dangerous area. And that was really heavy. And it was earth shattering to, you know, see that they felt comfortable there. But for me to be there, it was like, why is this young white woman here? She doesn't belong here. And we are concerned for her. And that was really cool because they spoke up to me once I, you know, spoke up to them and told them I was friendly and didn't make them feel like they were judged for being whoever they were, whatever stigmatism they might have about me. Mm-hmm. And when that fell, we could actually, like, communicate on common ground, and they were there for me and they wanted to, like, protect me. And that's why I think that it's amazing that I can come out here and speak on this platform and in different platforms and be the voice for those people.
Well, I'm so glad you're here as a voice in the world, Amanda. Thank you. And it is enriching to be involved in these projects and in these efforts that are so needed. And as you said, anybody can step up and do something. And that's what's going on right now with this collective new beginning that we're in this year with the political situation going on, and more people are definitely inspired to step up and want to be involved, hence the the cities across America who were involved in the Women's March. Would you like to share, Angela, with us what have your key interests been in experience? I know you've worked in Washington.
Worked in D.C.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I really like your collective new beginning, because I feel like that's where I've been for the last few years. And as far as where my passions have been, I'm also here because of the ERA, something that I learned about when I was in college back in the day, 25 years ago at Old Dominion in the Women's Studies program. And as soon as I came back to Asheville recently, I met an amazing woman named Roberta Madden, who's been working on the ERA for 45 years. And I thought, you know, here I'll be able to really get involved with some grassroots education on why it's so important right now for women to be educated and understand that we need to get the ERA passed. And then another big area for me is women in business. I've been a small business owner most of my adult life after I was in the military. And through that business, I was involved with international exchange students, college age, J-1 visas. And when I was in Charlotte a couple of years working on a contract, I was involved with an organization called International House, which is a powerful organization in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I was lucky to home host some legislative fellows from all over the world. And that was a Clinton initiative. There were three lawyers, one from Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Sri Lanka. And then I had the one that I home hosted was the UN Women director at the time, which UN Women was new because they had consolidated some groups. So through International House, I decided when I went back from my MBA to do an international business management program, and then traveled with international students to Brazil year before last to an emerging market. And so that's where my heart lies, are in those two issues. And then my last thing, coming back to Asheville, I was introduced to the Collider. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Collider. Mm-hmm. It is tied to NOAA here, and the climate, I don't want to get the name wrong, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And the Collider is this neat incubator for business, for new businesses that can capitalize on the climate data to help other businesses through the changes that are going to be coming down the pike. And it's right here in Asheville. So that's huge for me. And if anybody isn't familiar with it, they'd be happy to give you a tour up there and kind of let you know what's going on. But those are my three focuses.
Mm. Thank you, Angela, for doing the work you do in the world.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Kendall. Yeah.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Kendall. Yes, you're fairly known in the community. You've been here 20-some years, right, in Asheville? And
yeah, about
active.
25 years from Boston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So what have your key interests been? Are there too many to...
Well, I'm the older in the group. I don't know, but I kind of got that feeling. my mother was a feminist.
Okay.
She had Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex in the house, and I read it when I was, I think, in high school. And so I became aware of just women's oppression at a pretty early age because she had a lot of issues. My grandmother had a lot of issues. And I knew that there was something wrong with the culture, that these smart women had met so many blocks in their lives and didn't have the choices that they felt like they really, you know, the way that they wanted to manifest their growth as a human being and as a woman just wasn't accessible. And so when I got to the University of Wisconsin, of course, that was during the anti-war movement, the war against the war in Vietnam. But my parents were very political. My mother was a civil rights activist. My father was a professor at Ohio State University and one of the first professors to speak out against the war. So I had a framework going on in my mind about a lot of social justice issues from quite a young age. They went to the 63 March on Washington. So I was ripe for all of these social justice issues. I went to college in 1968, and the women's movement was just going through what we now call the second wave of feminism. The first wave was really the suffragettes. And I know my mom used to say, "You'll never know, Kendall. How can I explain to you what it was like? I was born in 1920, and that's when women received the right to vote, and you just can't imagine what it was like." And I remember looking at her, just kind of scratching my head. But you know, I understand that perspective now, but when we hit the campuses, you know, women's issues, it was Roe v. Wade. I mean, abortion had been illegal until 73. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that wave of feminism and then, you know, Gloria Steinem, and there were just so many feminists writing books. I mean, I remember a book called Sisterhood is Powerful by, I think, Robin Morgan was her name. And so the consciousness-raising groups just began to start again. And so I was involved from the very beginning in the gay rights, lesbian rights, and it was so potent then because everyone was looking, African-American liberation. There was so much going on that it was just part of the milieu. And I joined a women's collective and dropped out of college and moved away across the country to Portland. And, you know, we were really class conscious at that point, and we were really determined to, like, start the revolution against the power structure. But we wanted women to be in the lead, and it was so hard at that time because, you know, young men were still incredibly sexist, and the patriarchy, even in the left, was very, very heavy. I mean, you couldn't really get into the Students for a Democratic Society as a leader unless you slept with some of these men. And so, you know, we were just coming out of our youth and becoming aware of that. So, you know, I became really strong around abortion rights, reproductive freedom. And I just kept moving on from there, but I was very class conscious. So when I got to Boston, I decided two things. I became a cultural worker. I helped form a band called New Harmony Sisterhood, which was a raving feminist band. And we wrote and composed. All the music we sang were about women. And it was like Harriet Tubman and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Amelia Earhart, and songs that we wrote about coming out. You know, several of the women in the band were gay, and so we got very well known in the Boston area for our feminist lyrics and our boldness about just harassment. I mean, some of the songs we sang, I can't quite believe that we sang them, you know, in the day. I don't know if I can sing them now.
I want to know.
You know? Oh, I would love to hear one.
This band.
Maybe in our break you can sing us a song, Kendall. So, what was the name of the group again?
It was called New Harmony Sisterhood Band.
I wonder if any of those songs are findable.
Some of them were. Like, we sang some, like, Union Maids. You can find that one. That was a
Union Maids?
Union Maids. I once was a union maid who never was afraid of the goons of the, you know. Anyways, it's a trade union song, but it was a lead by, you know, women. Women's, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. What that kind of leads into, I became a labor union organizer. Uh-huh. And so I went in, you know, there were so many people doing all kinds of organizing, and this women's group decided that we were going to go in and organize women working in the low-paid electronics industry, because they were getting paid $2.50 an hour. There were no unions, and they were all there were white working class women, but there were a lot of immigrant women working in these factories right outside Cambridge. You know, it was like before it was all outsourced. So I spent a lot of years helping to organize the unorganized women, and that was an incredibly challenging experience. And then the wages were so low, though, I decided to move into some of the heavy industry. And this leads into, I'm getting to where I'm going. You'll see the trail
sure.
Here. I got a job at the Quincy Shipyard, General Dynamics Shipyard, because there are all kinds of leftists and progressives that were going into to organize within the union. It was unionized, but there were terrible issues of, like, danger and toxicity and safety and just all kinds of problems, you know, exploitation of just the different categories of workers not getting paid the same. So I applied, and I was one of 50 women hired on a federal affirmative action contract in a shipyard of 5,000 men.
Oh, wow.
So that was an amazingly, it was frightening and challenging at the same time. So I was a welder, and I worked there 2 years, and I had to confront a lot of on-the-job harassment. And so this was, you know, there hadn't been women working in heavy industry, you know, in this country since World War II. And that's where Rosie the Riveter, you know, that's where it came from, because she became the icon of, like, the women who came in and then were told they should go back home and be homemakers after World War II. So when I decided to go to Washington – And my mother served, both my parents served in the war, but my mother was in the Waves. So I had some familiarity with the women's role, you know, in men's jobs during World War II. But I decided I'm going to go there to the Women's March as Rosie, like a reincarnated Rosie the Riveter. And so I went out and I bought a pair of mechanic overalls. I found one place in Asheville, and I found it, and it was a small man size, blue, you know, coveralls. Mm-hmm. And then I had my hard hat from the shipyard that I had painted a women's symbol on way back in the day in the late 70s. It was faded. So then I decided I was going to go dressed as her. So I had the helmet on, and I had Rosie the Riveter, you know, the polka dot, the red and the red background with the white polka dots on the top of the helmet. And then I dug out all these old buttons from the women's movement, women against sexual harassment, you know, women fight back buttons. These buttons are like old. I mean, they're like 30 and 40 vintage. Years old. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, and then I had a pin on the suit from the march that I went with from Asheville with my daughter for, I think it was in 2001, maybe? It was like a big march in D.C. for reproductive freedom and for abortion rights. So I had that button pinned on. And so then I thought, you know, what kind of slogans do I want to have on my sign? And it's interesting because someone interviewed me as I was going by with the 500,000 women and their allies. And she said, you know, you look like you've been around for quite a while. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, what do you think of this movement, this young, most people here are younger than you, or a great percentage of the women here are younger than you. And I said to her, well, you know, on the one hand, I am so excited to see what I think is like the third wave of feminism coming forward. But honestly, the demands that I have, and I held up my sign, are the same ones that I and the women in the women's movement in Boston anywhere were advocating for in the 80s, 70s and 80s. So I said, equal pay for equal work, a living wage, affordable child care, affordable housing. So I had the economic issues on one side of the sign, which relates to the ERA. And then, this relates to it too, on the other side of the sign, I decided to put the slogans that are directed at women, the threat to women's bodies. So the top one was stop all violence against women, because there's so many aspects to the harassment and, you know, beating and all of that. The violence is like a very wide...
Most dangerous place for a woman is in her own home.
Yeah. So I had that at the top. And then I had reproductive freedom as a second, and then health care for all, because that's so critical for everyone, but for women and their families. And then, but I said to the interviewer, the only one that's new on this list for me is climate justice. And so, you know, that was kind of said it all. It was like, I have been an environmental climate justice activist for the past 8 years, and done a whole lot of work around that. And it is a big concern for women and their families. But these other issues are just as relevant as they've always been. Not that we haven't made progress, but they're still unresolved.
And becoming more and more, like, frightening that things could swing either way.
Right. Yeah, so that's kind of how it... The welder thing and the unions and working women and all of it just kind of like culminated back. And it was incredible to be there. I mean, one thing I noticed was the whole pussy hat thing. I have some friends my age who were just so kind of affronted by using the word pussy. But, you know, I tried to like really sit with that and think about it. And really what it is taking back a word that's been used to insult a group of people, either by gender or by skin color or ethnicity. When the people of that category take the word back, which is what the young women were doing, you know, with the pussy hats, it disempowers the oppressor who's using the word. Mm-hmm. Because you're taking it back and you're wearing these beautiful pink hats.
Right.
You know, so it's like a real, again, a twist of language that is so important, languaging, and the fact that our president had been using these misogynist and really disturbingly insulting words and slogans.
Mm.
That was...
Yeah, and... Yeah. Right, go ahead, Angela. Yeah.
Well, and I was just going to say, even the history of Rosie the Riveter is fascinating in that, you know, that was a propaganda that was used by the government to get women to fill positions when the men were conscripted. And then they were paid usually 50% of what the men made while they were working those jobs. And then as soon as the war was over, there was a new wave of government propaganda that pushed them back into the home, and they were basically all fired from the places that they worked. So even Rosie the Riveter is kind of very interesting history for women if they want to, you know, Google it and kind of see the progression. And even in that, there are all these other issues that we're talking about because they still needed, you know, where were the kids? I mean, I don't even remember that from when I was studying it, but who kept the kids when it was all women working, and how did that happen? And so there's a lot of interesting questions and things to look at just in that period of our history.
Mm, yeah, thanks for that added information. Before we move on from Rosie the Riveter, I do want to share the exciting news that occurred with Kendall in D.C. dressed up as Rosie the Riveter. You have become famous, right? So share with us who took your picture.
Well, I have to laugh because I'm so not a fashion model, and I never have been. I was a hippie, right? I wore jeans every day of my life for years, and long, you know, Joan Baez hair, and my mother was so upset by the plainness of my... It was a costume, but it was very plain. So, and I never quite, you know, made it into the arena of Vanity Fair. But for some reason, they noticed me, and they were going around looking. You know,
at the march.
At the march, mm-hmm. in Washington. Right. So I had seen them, you know, with their cameras and their photographers, like, kind of walking around. And I thought, wow, that's great. They're going to get some beautiful shots of some of the women here. And then they kind of disappeared, and then suddenly they came back, and they just asked me if I wanted to be photographed and interviewed, so they put me on this stool. And then, you know, they took these pictures and they said, you know, I had to sign a release, and they said, well, we're taking many pictures and we're going to pick a few to put on our online edition. And lo and behold, I'm number 10. If you go to the link, there are 19 women, and they're, you know, all of us are really different looking. But again, I was older. And you can, you know, they were looking for a wide multiracial age range of people who's just stood out for one reason or another. So it was, my daughter was just ecstatic. You know, I thought it was just kind of, you know, awesome. Funny, but she was just like very, very excited.
Mom
at age 66 finally made it into Vanity Fair.
That's pretty awesome, Hallmark, that you achieved there. So I guess go to vanityfair.com or something like that, and you'd find
it
somehow.
Yeah, it's on the online. Of course, I didn't even know it was still a magazine. That shows how out of that world I am, but I was flattered anyway to be in it. And they had quotes from everyone, too.
Yeah,
they did ask us. So if you go to the read more, each person says why they were there.
Yeah, I did have a look. It is quite an array. Yeah. And so yeah, what an experience. And I want to hear more about the march, share with our listeners in just a minute. But I'm going to take a pause here. And if you have just joined us, I'm Laura Elliott, and you're listening to Wild Heart on WPVM at 103.7 FM. Which you can also tune into online at WPVMFM.org. And if you enjoy this program, you may also enjoy A Mindful Emergence with Eddie LeSure, and that's on Mondays at 7 p.m., and also A Better World on Thursdays at 5 p.m. with McNair Ezard, both very wonderful talk shows. And Before we get back to the march in Washington, D.C., I want to share a public service announcement for Elida Holmes. Did you know that you do not need to be married or wealthy to foster a child? Did you know that it is free when you foster to adopt? And did you know that we will support you through the entire process and during your placement? And do you have a question about fostering a child? Call Elida, that's E-L-I-A-D-A, at 828-713-5423. Whether you want to learn more or you are ready to start the journey of changing a child's life forever, they are here and want to talk to you. So again, the number to reach Elida's foster care department is 713-5423. There's so many issues that abound that are in need. And so thank you again, ladies. With me today is Kendall Hale, who was the one just speaking was at the march with the others, and her. We were just remarking about her photo being in Vanity Fair. and also Angela Stone and Amanda Krause. And speaking of march, what was revealed in our pre-show conversation was, Angela, you were saying that when you grew up in Asheville, there was a march downtown that was...
Not quite the same kind of march.
No, a different kind of march, but I thought it'd just be fun to share that I never heard such a thing, that there was a march in Asheville with animals, including elephants.
Yeah, when I was growing up, and I can't tell the years, I'm sure I could ask my dad or many, many other people, but when the circus came to town, they would actually parade the animals through the streets, and we would always stand somewhere around the Woolworth building. And to me, I remember that more than I even remember the circus. So just a parade of animals at downtown Asheville.
Yeah. When you said elephants, I didn't realize at first it was connected to the circus, but it is. It's quite a vision to think of elephants walking our streets. But so let's fast forward to Washington, D.C. Did either of you, Angela, did you go dressed up as anything in particular or any character or
No, yourself? I just dressed warmly.
Okay.
We carried some signs. Mm-hmm. The women that I went with from here, there were three from Asheville, and then we met a woman who was in Manassas where we stayed. So there were four of us that went there from here in my group. I mean, I know there were hundreds from Asheville, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Amanda?
I drove up by myself to meet my sister up in Northern Virginia, and I went up early to actually help out with another event, which was on Friday before the march, and that's another story, though. So, I wore my tie-dye overalls and my pussy hat that my sister got from Busboys and Poets. They were giving out ones that had been sent there from all over the country. It was really cool, so... Uh-huh. We then had a whole bunch to give away to other people, which is awesome because the excitement was there. So we were able to draw more people in to go with us.
Right. Yeah. So let's share some stories of your experience at the march. Anything in particular you want to share about your time there that day or what the receptivity was like? Any particular incidents or
Well, I grew up in Northern Virginia, and I've been to the National Mall so many times. I actually went to preschool at the Smithsonian, which is on the National Mall. One of the buildings is the Red Castle building where I went to preschool, and the other was the American History Museum. So every time something happens there, it's just really eerie because it feels like my life has continued so much around that area. And that was the biggest gathering of people I've ever been in. Mm. And it was so powerful, and you felt like you were there and trying to connect with people. And if you hadn't gone with them, you probably weren't going to find them until hours later. Because if you were in the street at some points, there was a complete standstill. And It was like everyone was sardines in the street, and there was no one who was actually unhappy about it. We were all just like, we're here to hold space and show that we really care about something. And everyone was smiling. Some people were really like confused because they didn't know which direction to go. And there, everybody lost cell phone service at different parts. I had to like walk onto the National Mall to get cell phone service because there were so many people. It reminded me of actually during 9/11 when people lost cell phone service and you couldn't get in touch with anyone because there were so many people trying to communicate at one time. But eventually I found Camila Lopez and Natalie White and Elizabeth Jagger and my friend Adam Eidinger, and they had a sound system, and my other friend Felicia. And I found them because they had a gold star balloon and a sound system. So it kind of reminded me of festivals when you're trying to find a group of friends and the only way to see them is by their quote unquote rage sticks, like giant sticks that everyone makes so that you can find your friends or your campsite or something like that. And we had a microphone and we were all having like dance party around and encouraging people to do different things like join us in song or what to do to follow up after the march, just different ways to find information by going to equalmeansequal.com or equalrightsamendment.org or different things like that, and trying to actually rally people around one central issue, which is the Equal Rights Amendment, because there were so many people there, I felt like, who had different ideas about what we were all there for, which is a beautiful thing, but at the same time, when you spread yourself thin and have so many different topics, it's kind of hard. Like, you need to pick one thing, do it, and then move on to the next thing and just keep the momentum going. My personal favorite moment was when they played that song by the Rolling Stones, I Fought the Law and the Law Won, and I grabbed the microphone and I was like, all right, next time they sing it, like we did the whole first verse, and I said, next time we're going to say, I fought the law and the law changed. And I got like, it seemed like at least 500 people were around that circumference of the area. And so we were all chanting, I fought the law. And then Adam would turn the music down and we'd say, the law changed altogether. And it was so beautiful because it felt like we all, when you all get someone like everybody on the same vibration and the same frequency, and that's what language is and song is, it's a powerful thing.
It really is. Yeah. Yes. It has effects far wider, you know, beyond what meets the eye. So, yeah. And do we know, what was an estimate of how many? Do you, anyone recall?
I think there was, later I heard there were like 2 million people.
Worldwide, I think.
Worldwide.
Yeah, there was pretty much a consensus that it was 500,000.
500,000 in D.C.
Yeah, in D.C.
The joke I had going with both of my Lyft driver and Uber driver on Friday and the following day. On Friday, I said, you know, how's business going? Are you, like, getting a lot of rides? And on Friday, they were like, no. I said, Trump can't surge, bad for business. And then the next day, there's huge surge.
Interestingly, while we were waiting for the actual march to start or people to start funneling in one direction, because it was everybody kind of doing their own thing all day, I found out from a woman who worked downtown and helped. She wasn't one of the direct organizers, but to the side, that they had actually, and I don't want to get this wrong, but they had turned off something that counted the tweets. So one of the, I guess they were using like crowd scientists to try and figure out the size of the crowds and also how many people had taken the metro. And I kept asking all day, why are there no food vendors here? There were literally empty places for food vendors where they had been for the inauguration, but we had no water. Now down on the side streets, perhaps, but we got there at 7 a.m. and it was 6 o'clock at night before we could get out and down a side street. And we finally found one food vendor. And as a business person, I kept thinking, let me go back a step. What I was told is because they had the runaround to get this organized until literally the day before, they could not nail down all these things that you would normally have had access to. So it created some issues, but I thought for 500 and doubled the size they expected. And for all of those issues, no food, no water, permission given the day before, and double the amount of people, I thought it was phenomenal the way that it all turned out. And I just wanted to point out those some of those hurdles that they had trying to get this accomplished, because, you know, kudos to those, I think it was four women that got this going and the permissions, and, you know, they stuck with it, even though they kept being denied and then approved at the last minute. And then for it to turn out like it did was phenomenal, I think.
The perseverance, energy of perseverance, yeah, says a lot. Yeah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the firsts for me and my husband and I have been in many, many, many protests and actions during our 35-year marriage, but this was the first time that our son and our daughter and we were together. The first time, because it just never happened that we were actually in the same city at the same moment and agreed on what the commonality of the issue was or the type of action that it was. And so since this was nonviolent and it wasn't going to be an arrestable action, which I've been involved with many times, and my son doesn't always approve of that, although he's coming around to seeing that it's a tactic that can
civil disobedience be, work sometimes.
Yeah, and my daughter just had a baby who's going to be two, so I'm a grandma now, and so I think, you know, there's been an awakening on many levels for so many people, and I think what was wonderful was first there was controversy of, oh, this was a white women's upper middle class, you know, march and on and on, and it was like, oh, it's not going to be intersectional in the proper way, or it's, you know, it just raised a lot of controversy, and it really turned out to be so broad-based. I felt like I saw slogans from all sectors about many, many issues. I mean, women's predominantly, which is what it should have been, but I mean, women's issues span a lot, so my son and daughter felt completely comfortable, and I think if it hadn't been following Trump and all of the other policy, upsetting policies that he's been pushing, as we all know, this last week has been pretty frightening and traumatic and disturbing, I think all of that contributed to everyone feeling a sense of underlying unity, that men felt comfortable there as women's allies and, you know, the Muslim community and Hispanics, and it was very multiracial. And I couldn't hear half the people speaking because I was so far back, and there were screens, you know, all along, but I could never really see anyone. I mean, I could hear, and I recognized Michael Moore, and I recognized Madonna, but beyond that, I just really missed out on a lot. But it didn't really take away from what was going on right around me, because everyone was just so animated wherever they were. A little claustrophobic. It did get scary at a few moments because I could hardly breathe. That felt like I was, you know, like a sardine, and nobody knew what was going on. It was true. People kept saying, people were turning their backs on the stage finally and saying, march, march, march. And the speakers just kept going on and on and on.
Oh, right.
They couldn't hear us. And so finally, people were trampling kind of over, you know, walls and gardens to get out the sides. And I followed a woman in a wheelchair. Someone said, oh, she was a centurion. I don't know. But everybody was like, oh, my gosh. So we were following her because people were parting, you know. So we were just starting a chain of people. And then that's when, you know, we didn't know that it was so huge that was why nobody could move, because there was nowhere to move until it finally just got dawned on people that they had to just start to clear out so others could come. So anyway.
yeah, well, that's, yeah, that happened here too in the Asheville March. There were a lot of preliminary presentations, talks, and there were people that got impatient and started yelling, march, march, march. But I can imagine, just, it sounds like it was well done for the humongous nature of it, despite that. But Angela, what was
just going to say, and a shout out, because as far as I could tell, I'm not a crowd scientist, but there weren't a lot less men there than women, which I was
There were not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was, what almost, you guys say? I mean, maybe a 30%, 40%?
Probably 30%. I saw a lot of men that I didn't expect to see.
But it was definitely huge.
Felt like there were more pink hats and everything. Maybe yeah. the men were well, wearing the pink
the
hats,
The men
too.
Were wearing the pink hats. And I saw lots of couples and lots of families, and it was very intersectional, which is a new women's studies word. I know they were showing photos of a lot of white women flying in, but again, that might be an economic. On the ground, it was very diverse.
Okay.
And I think, if I read correctly, 1,200 buses, and then the people that drove in. So I think it was pretty well a mixed group there.
And you had a situation, Angela, where you were in the march, there was a Trump float that came yeah. in your
well,
direction.
Well, first, let me say
you.
We were there all day from 7 till 6:30 is when we finally started moving out down a street back towards where we had parked. And so this was not really at all a part of the parade route. But we got to an intersection and there was, I mean, it looked like a New York parade float. It was huge, and it had Bikers for Trump were beside the parade float, and they had bullhorns, and they were trying to turn towards the mall, and this group of college girls ran out and laid down in the road, and then the crowd surged behind them. And I was with a friend who couldn't afford to lose her job or be on national television. So she took off running and we went across the street because I really wanted to see what was going to go down. And the police came and everybody talked to everybody. And the guy on the bullhorn, obviously there were no arrests. So they figured it out. But it was very interesting, and it was just one young woman to begin with. She just laid right down in front of this parade float, and we were like, oh. But it was within seconds that the entire street went over there, so he couldn't have gotten through anyway. But yeah, and then in my mind, I'm like, how did he get permission when we don't have food vendors and water to go? You know, I mean, I was trying to figure that out, too, or maybe he was just random. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that was the only time all day that I saw any, and that was 12 hours later and on our way out. But they must have, you know, handled that. So
wow. Something I'm curious about, you know, aside from Vanity Fair, did you see many journalists there? Because I read something that there weren't many journalists on the ground. They had people talking on news stations, journalists, and speculating and talking about it. But I read a journalist, I can't recall who it was, who was remarking that there was a significant lack of people their present interviewing. He called journalism 101. Where were the interviews out there with the people?
I think that may have had something to do with the permitting that didn't go through until the day before.
Okay.
I'm just guessing. But those things are usually, having organized things, the news, sure they can show up at the spur of the moment, but at the same time, if they're bringing their equipment, you know, those places were all empty. So I'm guessing, you know, that was part of the permit holdup.
Mm. It was probably hard to get into to the area where we were on Madison and 7th. We had a big speaker, so we were drawing a lot of attention. And that wasn't too far off from another road that wasn't as blocked. And so I did see some cameras come in, but it was a lot less cameras than I thought that I would have seen myself.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I don't know how many reporters were not there, but I have to say the next morning I ran out and bought a copy of the New York Times because it was huge on the front page. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the big article right on the front page. And it was the Washington Post the same. And, you know, I've been in D.C. when there's been 100,000 people or more, and it's never been reported out in either paper. And this was so big. And again, following on this very disturbing attack that our president has made on the media, especially the New York Times, recently telling them to shut up. So I think they were definitely going to be there because they've already had, you know, entanglements with freedom of, you know, the press being threatened by the White House. So, but, you know, they may have had their, I don't know how they got those aerial shots or where they were, but it might have been that they had special places to go to since they're such big news outlets. But we did get on the cover of Time magazine. There was this beautiful, it was a front cover of the pink pussy hat, and it said, how a march becomes a movement. And I haven't had a chance to read that article, but I was really happy that I'd like to read the analysis of how they see that blossoming. Because a march is great, but it's only a beginning.
Right.
So that, you know, I'm sure lots of us are thinking about that, too. And
yeah, sounds like it will be a good read. I'll have to check that out. Yes, Angela?
I hope, and I had actually sent this in, I hope that they pick up the ERA mantle. I mean, we're all here as a part of that. But that's a basic foundation for every other right. And until women are covered by the Constitution, and that's a lot of the pushback I have from conservative, especially conservative men. They're like, what rights do you not have? And my answer to that is, one, the right to vote, and everything else, we are not covered. We may win things at the local and state level, but when it gets to the Supreme Court, as Scalia said, there's nothing that says we can't be discriminated against. Right. So we lose these lawsuits at the Supreme Court level, and that affects family leave, pay equality, everything, environmental issues, because as you pointed out, how...
Oh, right. So yesterday I was having a conversation with my friend, and she said, women's rights don't matter because if the environment is shot, then what does it matter if we have rights? And I said, well, if women aren't making as much as a man, and if Latino women are making less than white women, then and then African-American and then white women, and they're still making less than a man in equal jobs, then they can't fight for the environment. So it's all related. Everything is related, and we just have to open our hearts to not judging each other and opening our hearts into actually letting people have a living wage and fair housing so that they can go on and speak up for the things that actually affect them on a level of human rights. And that's why we need to have these like basic things that food security, shelter, those are the basic things that everyone needs. And once we go up, like once we have those things, we'll be able to learn and grow as a society and make amazing things happen and clean up all of the mess that we've made over this industrial age. And we're coming out of that into this other age of solar, wind power, and all these other beautiful things, soil regeneration. We have the information to be able to save the planet and our species and other species that we're threatening right now. But if we don't acknowledge the fact that people have the right to live a life that is not compromised in terms of food and shelter and healthcare, then
A lot of it is awareness, the need to educate. And so this documentary film, Equal Means Equal, is significant. Kamala, is that how you pronounce her? Yeah, Kamala Lopez is the director and creator of this. Last year it came out.
It took 2015. Her 8 years.
Yeah, quite an amazing project. If you go on to equalmeansequal.com, fabulous story and all the details about the film. And so we're showing it. A group of us here in Asheville have gotten together to join this current movement, because there is a renewed movement that's often called the third wave to ratify the ERA. And we're showing the film at the block off Biltmore in downtown Asheville on Market and Eagle on February 12th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And please come and see it. And the block off Biltmore.com, if you need to research further information about that, an awesome cafe, vegan bar that supports a lot of these efforts. And it is amazing that the United States is one of four countries in the world that does not have an equal rights amendment in its constitution for women. And most people don't know, many people don't know that.
Yeah,
sorry.
For the, For that reason, we haven't passed the United Nations Bill of Rights for Women, and we are one of seven countries in the United Nations that hasn't passed that. We're behind Rwanda in terms of gender equality, and we're supposed to be a leader of the world. So we really need to take this step and get the Equal Rights Amendment passed.
Quite perverse.
And I also, this is something that's important to me as far as what's probably coming down the pike with more marches. Well, two things. One, if you've never watched the movie Iron Jawed Angel, it goes hand in hand with Equal Means Equal, because it walks you through even the legislative, how they started, how they raised funds. It's a powerful movie. It has Hilary Swank. You can find it on Amazon. And anybody that has an issue that they want to start in their kitchen, that movie literally walks you through. And that was to get us the right to vote, which brings me to my other big thing, which is we're going to, again, have pushback. And it took 153 years to get the right to vote, and we had a lot of anti-suffragettes, and I'm sure you guys have all seen on Facebook already the pushback, but don't be discouraged. This is the way it's always been.
Right.
We're always going to have pushbacks. We had women that were literally campaigning against women getting the right to vote. So all of these issues, we've always had pushback, and so just keep, you know, watch the documentaries and stay, you know, engaged and energetic, and just expect that it'll be there, and don't be discouraged.
Good point. Thanks. And Equal Means Equal is also a book. Not very thick. It's not, you know, it's a little heavy on information, but it's, you know, one of the recent histories with the effort to ratify the ERA is, you know, in 1972, it was passed by Congress, and it needed a certain number of states to pass it to go into the Constitution. And there was a 10-year window to do this, and by 1982, we were three states short. So North Carolina was one of those three states.
North Carolina, Virginia, Florida, all Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi. Yeah, a lot of the southern states, southeastern states, and then Utah, New Mexico, Nevada. But we can pull through and get three. They're expanding lengthening the limit on getting the three-state thing passed. So that can happen. We can get those three states.
And I think I saw something that it's going to be introduced into the North Carolina GA in February. I think on February 14th, it's going to be introduced again. Saw that on an email today.
Exciting. And if you want, I'm just making sure I have the website correct, because this is something that, as I said, Roberta Madden's been working on for 40 years.
She's from Black Mountain.
She's in Black Mountain. And if you want to be involved with her effort and many of the other efforts around, you can go to era-nc.org. Again, it's era-nc.org. And there's a lot of activity to try and get it on there coming up soon. So. We need as many people that are willing to do as much as possible in a short period of time. So, you know, this isn't a long strategy. We have a short strategy, and we need lots of people willing to write and call and try to move this forward as quickly as possible.
And in 82, the two reasons why the ERA didn't get passed, gay marriage and fear of same gender bathrooms, we have both of those now.
Wow.
So. Right. Not be afraid.
Okay. Well, we've got another minute. Anything else y'all would like to say?
No, I liked what you were saying about the suffragettes, because I can't remember who the president was, but I remember in the film they were standing in front of the White House, and this is the pushback. The president said, you know, how dare you protest when, I think it was during World War I. And so it was like, once again, there's always some reason that women have to wait, because there's always, like you were saying, the climate crisis. There's always some other major disaster that we're all supposed to drop everything for until some perfect world happens, and then we finally get to push out again. And it's true. I mean, they have to move together. There's just no excuse to say, you know, because I remember I said to somebody on an email, I said, you know, I thought about what if we lived in this perfect, sustainable, you know, world where there was no fossil fuels, and but women were still second-class citizens. And I said to him, no, thank you. You can count me out.
That's a good note to end on.
And thank you for having us here today.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, wonderful to have you all. Thank you, Kendall Hale, Angela Stone, and Amanda Krauss. And please do again come to see